I set it up with logistics of family life. But it's my kind of weird. It's wonderful to be back here. It's so nice to come back to a place where we know the places and we recognize some of the houses on the way past, some of the farms where we had so much fun last year. And just to be part of Christian community, that sort of family sense is wonderful. Right, this talk tonight is an interesting one. Some point last year we were preparing for a conference with Ray, who most of you might have heard last night. And we were talking about important topics, things that we thought needed to be addressed within sort of the sphere of apologetics. And I said, you know, one of the things that we as apologists often champion and talk about importance is the role of critical thinking and logic. We often speak about that, and we'll often say to people, this is important, teach it to your children, use it when you do your Bible study, use it when you speak to atheists or people who are non-Christians. But we never really give people an idea of exactly what it is. What do we mean when we say critical thinking? What is logic? And we live, unfortunately, in a time when people don't know anymore. This used to be standard fare for elementary school children. In days gone by, in a more sort of classical education. And we are the generation that is the result of modern education, where this just does not get done anymore. And it's crucial, I think, to specifically the defense of the faith. So I piped up and said, well, what about a talk on critical thinking and logic? And Ray said, well, there you go. That will be your topic for this conference. And so it is not the most exciting one ever. There are very few songs and dances that you can do about logic. Simon said, well, you can tell a couple of jokes. I said, well, I'm not even sure if those are in there. So hang in there with me. If there's anything that I say that's not quite clear, please stop me right there and then. And let me say, this is going to be like the world's shortest introduction ever to what is really a very broad topic. And my aim will simply be to convince you that this is important. And then even if it's for a couple of minutes in the car a day or in your restroom, to have a logic book and to start looking at some of these arguments, some of the fallacies, will enrich specifically your intellectual life. And so that's my aim today. So I will be referring to my notes quite a bit because it does get somewhat technical. That's not because I haven't prepared, but it's because I want to tell you what's here, because this is the good stuff and I won't lose track otherwise. So, like I said, there was a time when logic was an integral part of a person's schooling. Unfortunately, those days are long gone. Most people don't even know where to start the endeavor of training the mind. So today's talk is an attempt to convince you of two things. Number one, that the study of logic is worth your while. And number two, that it is doable. In fact, that it is necessary, especially if you want to defend the faith. See, the defense of the faith is in large part giving an argument. Now, by that I don't mean fisticuffs and big old shouting match. I mean a syllogism. I mean premises that lead to a conclusion. I mean knowing the truth and being able to express that. And if we as apologists are not able to give good arguments, we won't be able to debunk bad arguments either. And so this is the aim of the talk, is to convince you that we need to be able to, number one, make sure that our own arguments are sound and valid, and number two, be able to pick up on invalid arguments, arguments that are not sound, premises that are not true, and be able to address those. Let me ask you, this is a silly question, but oblige me for a moment. Please raise your hand if you can read. Okay. Now, please raise your hand if at any point in your education you were required to take a class in formal logic. Okay, 1.5. Right. I'd like you to listen very carefully to what Dorothy Sayers, the author, playwright, and scholar of classical and modern languages, said in an essay that she delivered at Oxford University in 1947, a while ago. The essay was titled The Lost Tools of Learning, and in it she says the following. I'll put it up there as well for those of you who are visual learners. She says, "We let our young men and women go out unarmed in a day when armor was never so necessary. By teaching them all to read, we have left them at the mercy of the printed word. By the invention of the film and the radio, we have made certain that no aversion to reading shall secure them from the incessant battery of words, words, words. They do not know what the words mean. They do not know how to ward them off, or blunt their edge, or fling them back. They are prey to words in their emotions, instead of being the masters of them in their intellects. We, who were scandalized in 1940 when men were sent to fight armored tanks with rifles, are not scandalized when young men and women are sent into the world to fight mass propaganda with a smattering of subjects, and when whole classes and whole nations become hypnotized by the arts of the spellbinder. I imagine she had Nazi Germany in vivid memory here. We have the impudence to be astonished. We dole out lip service to the importance of education, lip service and just occasionally a little grant of money. We postpone the school leaving age and plan to build bigger and better schools. The teachers slave conscientiously in and out of school hours, and yet, as I believe, all this devoted effort is largely frustrated because we have lost the tools of learning, and in their absence can only make a botched and piecemeal job of it. Okay, so what does she mean? She's saying, we are teaching our children the context of these subjects, but we never teach them how to think. The tools of learning, the thinking skills to apply to the information that we are giving them. So one of the tools of learning that she refers to is formal logic. She suggests its return. She says, it is here that our curriculum, the curriculum that she's proposing, shows its sharp divergence from modern standards. The disrepute into which formal logic has fallen is entirely unjustified, and its neglect is the root cause of nearly all those disquieting symptoms which we have noted in the modern intellectual constitution. She lists these earlier in the essay. She talks about how the person with the modern education is unable to navigate through life, and it's almost prophetic. If you read it, you see the thinkers of today. You see people who get swept over by the media unthinkingly, people who get influenced by ideas that feel nice instead of are true. And so logic has been discredited partly because we have come to suppose that we are conditioned almost entirely by the intuitive and the unconscious, that which sort of enters us by osmosis. Okay. There is no time to argue whether this is true. I will simply observe that to neglect the proper training of the reason is the best possible way to make this true. Have you ever considered that your reason can be trained? The way you think should be trained. It's sort of like you train a muscle. You are not going to be born naturally a good thinker. This is something that needs to be developed. So Sayers is saying that without an understanding of and an ability to apply formal logic, we become people who are hopeless against the onslaught of words and ideas. We live according to what we feel and not according to what we know. And why is this dangerous? Because emotions have never been a good test or barometer for truth. Unthinking men and women are most easily led astray by the crazy ideas of the day. So, can you offer resistance? Sayers' essay is accessible on the web. If you type in Dorothy Sayers, Lost Tools of Learning, I encourage you to read it and to see, perhaps test yourself against some of those, some of the predictions concerning the results of modern education, and see whether you're a product of that, some of the intellectual shortcomings. I was startled to find myself in there, certainly. Okay, so on a little more of a sort of a practical level, have you ever listened to a conversation in which two individuals support opposing ideas, and you felt with much frustration that the conversation was going nowhere? You're not quite able to put your finger on it, but something is missing, something is out of sync, and somehow the whole thing is just a supreme waste of time. I experienced some of this frustration in watching the last presidential debate between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. Now, granted, I don't have a particularly firm grasp on American politics, and so some of it, perhaps, I missed the nuances. But I was aware that nothing much was being achieved in this discussion. Questions were asked that were never answered. Statements with seemingly no relevance to the topic was made continuously, and more attention was paid to the color of the spousal outfits than the actual content of the arguments. I found it to be thoroughly frustrating and deeply dissatisfying. And this feeling of frustration is that barrage of words that I think Sayers referred to with a military metaphor. It seems to me that both candidates were the victims of an inability to track with the arguments and to respond to each other's arguments and to express their own thoughts clearly. And the audience did not possess the critical skills to assess the conversation, to see who was really making a good and a valid point. And so one's choice for the winner of the debate ended up being the one with the best facial expressions and the one who came across most smoothly, the one who didn't suffer, never mind exactly what he said, as long as he came over sort of smoothly and charismatically. Very, very dangerous for choosing the most powerful man in the world. So, Sayers thought that she lived in a time of bombardment of words. She had books, films, and newspapers, and the radio. Little did she know of the exponential escalation that would come with the invasion of television and the internet into every aspect of our lives. We are piled under by information daily. We are at the mercy of thousands of words. And if we don't have the tools of logic and critical thinking, we have no shovel, we have no resistance. Okay? And so this is why it is important. We are fortunate to live in a place where physical martyrdom is not a reality as far as our Christian faith is concerned. We've become very much aware of that with some of what's going on in the Middle East. We're not subject to physical violence because of what we believe, but we are bombarded with verbal attacks. You come across these guys, the Four Horsemen. These are the so-called new atheists, vitriolic apologists for atheism. They write books concerning the matter. They take on Christian apologists in debate. So as apologists, we would like to be able to defend our beliefs against these attacks and perhaps even tear down some of these strongholds, these skeptical strongholds. But it's not possible if we can't find our way through the rhetoric and the propaganda, if we can't get to the argument, if we don't have the tools to make sense of the tens of thousands of words that are flung to us, we can't offer a defense. So, studying and understanding logic is the first step in winning this war against words. I hope that I've convinced you that it's important. Now, I'm going to do some quick definitions. What is logic? Maybe you're sitting here thinking, I'm not even sure what it is, so we'll look at that quickly. And then try and say why is it important, show you how it applies. Okay, there are various definitions of logic. The Oxford English Dictionary is sort of cryptic and a little bit technical. It defines logic as reasoning conducted or assessed according to strict principles of validity, so sort of rules of validity. Maybe simpler, logic studies reason itself as a tool of knowledge. So it's not that you think, it's how you think. The tool of knowledge. Logic is not thinking, it is the means by which you think, sort of the process, if you want. Or logic is the study of right reason or valid inferences and the attending fallacies, formal and informal. So fallacies are mistakes in your thinking, mistakes in your reasoning, so logic points those out and then corrects the reasoning. My favorite, logic simply means putting your thoughts in order. It means a relief from what I felt that evening watching that debate, just thinking, it's like Simon uses the phrase mental constipation. Right. Here is a very broad, a very sort of all-encompassing definition of logic that I quite like, given by one of our professors, and I'll go through it slowly. He says, logic is the instrument or tool of human knowledge, and as a discipline or an area of study, it involves the study of the science and art of right, meaning correct reasoning, that directs and guides the faculty of reason. so as in, to enable one to advance, in other words, move forward, with order, ease, and correctness in the act of reason. Wouldn't that be nice? To be able to move forward in your thinking with order, with ease, and correctness. Get away, get all of that mumbled fluff, and actually get to the point. Why is it a science? Well, it's a science because there are certain principles. There are certain ways in which arguments are formed that are correct. But it's also an art because you have to be skillful in the way that you apply these. You have to practice at them. And so you get better at doing them. Okay, so it was this order of ease and reasoning that I was missing in the debate. I was not able to advance into active reason, so I was unable to apply the tools of logic you were thinking. Now, if there was a true logician in the room, maybe there is, I apologize, you would say, well, that's very broad. If you do a Wikipedia search on logic, you'll see that it is a huge discipline. There are all sorts of weird types of logic out there. Mathematical logic, syllogistic logic, propositional logic, predicate logic, modal logic, computational logic, and lots of people who invest their lives in those, even weirder than us here tonight. But few people are capable of that sort of abstract reasoning. What I want to focus on tonight is logic as a tool for human reason. First and foremost, it's practical. It applies to you. Why? Because of the type of being that you are. You are a human being, and human beings reason, which means you use logic either badly or well. You can't escape it because this is simply your nature. From a very young age, you start to think. You realize, for example, that it is impossible to be in the same place and on two different places at the same time. Okay, that is simply logic or thinking at work. Okay, so I'm going to focus on classical or Aristotelian logic for those of you who are interested in more sort of the technical aspect. And the reason why is I think it has as its goal the actual improvement of human thinking. It can mean something to us practically, to the man on the street. Okay, so that is logic. Now, why should you do it? Number one, logic is unavoidable. You're doing it anyway, whether you like it or not. And even if you deny logic, if you say, well, I don't think logic is important, you are using, for example, the principle, the law of non-contradiction. Something either is or is not the case, can't be the case and not be the case at the same time. You are saying it's not the case, I'm saying it is, and so really there is a logical distinction there. So even in denying it, you are using it. It's sort of like speaking a language without knowing the grammar. Maybe you were one of those people who hated English class and hated grammar, and that rebelled against learning it. Well, you're going to use it anyway. You're just going to be speaking real badly because you're not going to understand the principles. You're not going to understand how the language is shaped. If you study grammar, you will use, I don't know, your tenses correctly, use appropriate word order, and you will be able to express yourself better. And so it is unavoidable. It's sort of like engineering, building a house. You can build a house by trial and error, figure out, you know, where the forces are at work and your house falls down a couple of times. Or you can go and you can learn the principles of engineering and then build the house in a much shorter time with fewer accidents. And so that's the idea. Logic is sort of like those principles of engineering, and instead of just making a half job of building your house, your thinking can actually be structured accordingly. Okay. Logic is undeniable. It's simply the fact that nature imposes some principles on some certain parameters on the mind. So you think, for example, of the law of identity. A is A. A thing is what it is. It can't be what it is and something else at the same time. It's just the way nature works. It's just the way God made it. And thank God for that, because how would we understand a thing which could be itself and not itself at the same time? It's just not the way our thinking is structured. And so these principles are undeniable. If you deny the principles of logic, you are actually using logic to do that. And so you just can't get away from it. Sometimes people will say, well, you know, logic in our day and age, it just doesn't seem to work. People aren't reasonable anyway. So they're just going to believe whatever they want, whether I am reasonable or not. That in itself is a logical argument. Things that do not work are not worth my time and effort. Logic does not work. Therefore, logic is not worth my time and effort. Okay? That is simply a syllogistic argument. And so even in saying that, you're using logic. But the primary reason for studying logic is not to convince other people. It's to make sure that you are thinking well. That your reason is in order. And if you have talked to people and you have presented a sound, valid argument, and they don't want to accept it, then that's their business. But especially as a Christian apologist, you should be able to present a good argument. And so really it starts with us. Why should you do this? So that you can be a better thinker. Okay. Finally, some people will sometimes have theological objections. Let me say this. Theological method builds on the laws of logic. When you read scripture, you employ your reasoning. When you think about who God is, you employ your reasoning. God is either changing or he's unchanging. He can't be both. And so when you come to a passage of scripture which says, for example, God changed his mind, okay, what do you do? You read the logic and say, well, it can't be one or the other. Which one is it? Therefore, perhaps this is metaphor. There's a different way to understand this. Okay? And so, in all of our theology, logic comes prior. Now, the very pious would sometimes say, but oh, no, no, no. Now you're putting reason before God. God comes first. Yes, in the nature of, in the order of being and existence, God comes first. But in the order of human knowing and understanding, thinking, logic comes first. And that is how I apprehend scripture and how I apprehend general revelation and come to know God. I use my mind. There is simply no other way. It's just the way that God created you. It's the nature of your being. Right. So, it's not that we examine God by our logic. It's that we examine statements or arguments about God with logic. And so it's not either impious or unholy to say we have to think critically, we have to think logically about our faith as well. Alright, now, the aim of tonight is to get to the latter part, to show you a couple of logical fallacies, the fun stuff, the stuff that you can be looking out for when you read that newspaper article, or when you listen to the next presidential debate, or even when you just read a book, maybe one of these apologetics books that you pick up. But that's sort of putting the cart before the horse, because really, in a traditional sort of logic class, you would learn the formal principles first and then move to the fallacies to see the false reasons. What I'm going to do is give you a very brief overview of some of the basic principles according to the sort of Aristotelian logic. And then towards the end, we'll see how many of these fallacies we can go through to give you something to work with. And hopefully, it'll whet your appetite for some more. So, a little bit of put off. If you want to go to sleep for this part, that's okay. I won't point you out and embarrass you. Aristotle recognized three acts of the intellect. He didn't invent these. He didn't start them. He simply saw that this is the way that human beings understand the world around them. Okay? Three acts, so it's sort of three stages in our understanding. Number one, simple apprehension. Number two, judgment. And number three, reasoning. Okay? So, he said, all knowledge begins in sense experience. There's nothing that you know that you haven't become aware of through sight, taste, touch, hearing, and maybe female intuition. All knowledge begins with sense experience. Even crazy creatures that you think up when you tell your children a story, it's still just a combination of things that you have experienced before through your senses. So all knowledge enters through the senses. There is nothing that is in your mind that was not first in your senses. And as you sense the world around you, you ask a primary question, the same as my three-year-old. What is it? Okay? Because God created the world, Aristotle said, well, he didn't say God created it, but Aristotle recognized that things have a nature. I look at that thing and I can ask the question, what is it? It is of a certain nature. And when I see something that is similar to that thing, I can say, aha, there's another tree. It has treeness, the nature of the tree. Even though it's not the same tree, there's something about trees that are the same.
about water bottles as well.
Okay, so this question concerns the nature or the whatness. The whatness of something. So, I'll use the example of a rabbit. The first rabbit our oldest daughter encountered was in the Beatrix Potter picture book. Okay, and I would point to it and say, rabbit. She saw more storybooks with rabbits. She encountered real bunnies in a cage on the farm, a little porcelain ornament in a friend's house, and finally we saw some rabbits in the wild. Initially, she kept asking, what is it? Or I would say, that is a rabbit. Before long, she didn't need to be told. She had recognized the nature or kind, and she was able to apprehend, simple apprehension, rabbitness. Okay? She could recognize that in these things around her. Which is uniform to all rabbits, regardless of whether they're fluffy or colored or well-fed or starving or on an Easter card or in a coloring book. There's something uniform about rabbitness, and she was able to recognize that. That is simple apprehension. She had formed what Aristotle would call the concept of rabbitness in her mind, and she assigned the term rabbit to it. Okay, now what's interesting, little illustration, this gets technical, don't worry if this doesn't make sense, there we go, it's not important, but just, the word I taught her was from my mother tongue, Afrikaans, it's actually haas, it's the word for rabbit, okay, so she had the concept of rabbitness, but she has a word, haas, for the term rabbitness. That's interestingly what makes translation possible, that human beings have the same concept that they abstract, the nature of the thing, and then they assign a term to it, rabbitness. But in Afrikaans, it's a haas, in English, it's a rabbit. I don't know, what's the German word for rabbit? Anybody know? Okay? Every language has its own word for this concept, which is why we can translate. We can go from one language to the next because there are these universal concepts that we've abstracted. Now, what is important in logic, in this first step of simple apprehension, is that when you come to the point where you have a term or a word, your definition is clear. What do you mean when you say? Okay, and this, in this very first step, is so important. I see this, for example, in the whole debate about homosexuality and marriage. There's a word that's flung around. People who are opposed to homosexuality will say that is unnatural. Okay, people who are for homosexual marriage or the homosexual lifestyle will say, no, there's nothing unnatural about it. This is a natural attraction. Do you know where the problem lies? It lies with the definition. The term natural is unclear. Nobody has defined what that means. If you're Aristotelian, you mean by that it is against human nature. There is a specific way in which human beings are to act, and this is not the way it should be. If you hold more of a sort of modern Rousseauian view of nature, then this is, nature is whatever you want to be. Okay, and so when I say nature as opposed to sexuality, to homosexuality, and the homosexual activist says nature, we are talking past each other because those terms are not clearly defined. We don't have the same concept in mind. And so can you see where some of the confusion starts? Right there at the very first act of knowing that your mind does. So, are your concepts clear? Are you clear in defining your terms? Right. So, terms, importantly, are not true and false. Okay? If I have a rabbit and I write the word rabbit, it's not true and false rabbitness, it's just the definition. It's what the thing is. The second part is judgment. This is where we start relating the concepts. We're putting our concepts together. And so now we ask the question, is it? Okay? So, for example, we relate the concept rabbit and animal. I say, the rabbit is an animal. I am making a judgment. Okay? Now, statements like these, propositions, they can be true or false. It's either true that rabbits are animals, or false that rabbits are animals. It's either true that Simon is a rabbit, or false that Simon is a rabbit. Okay? These are propositions. When I start putting these concepts together and making a judgment, by judgment I mean whether I say it is or it isn't. Okay? And then I put them in a declarative sentence. Every rabbit is an animal. That's my sentence. So propositions address the question whether something is or is not, and they are therefore true and false. So when I say, it is 6 o'clock, that proposition is either true or false. Okay, and now we're moving into when the debate candidate says, my tax plan will decrease taxes by 2.5%. That proposition is either true or false, and we can start asking questions about that. Okay. Then, in the third act, now we come to the good stuff, now we start to reason. Okay. The intellect relates two or more propositions together in order to form a conclusion. Now we progress to something that is known, from something that is known, a proposition, to something that was not known before. Okay. This is the intellectual act of producing arguments. Any argument has two structural parts to it, the premises and the conclusion. The conclusion is what you're working to. The premises are sort of your proofs, if you want. I'll give you an example in just a minute. The premises are the propositions that came from my judgment. They're the assumed evidence, and the conclusion is the proposition that you're trying to prove. Okay? So, I'll give you an argument. All men are mortal, premise one. Socrates is a man, premise two. Conclusion, Socrates is mortal. Okay? So from my two premises being true, knowing my two premises, I can now move to the conclusion that Socrates being a man is also mortal. Okay? That's what I mean. And that is the basic form of an argument. You'll hear the word sometimes syllogism. That's what it means. Now there are certain technical and formal ways in which that needs to be formed in order for it to be used correctly. We can't go there today. That's when it gets really fun. And that's when you become a good logician, when you understand those. There are two types of arguments. There are syllogisms, we'll go with arguments. Inductive and deductive arguments. Inductive reasoning moves from particular premises to a general conclusion. So, this rabbit has long ears. That rabbit has long ears. All the rabbits I've ever seen have long ears, therefore I come to the conclusion that all rabbits have long ears. Okay? Now you can see with an inductive argument, the conclusion is not always certain, because I have not seen all rabbits. There might be one with short ears. Or all swans are white, this one is white, that one is white, all the swans I've seen are white, therefore swans are white. Okay? This is inductive reasoning. Then there are deductive arguments. These are the ones where you move from universal propositions to a particular conclusion. So that was my example of Socrates just now. All men are mortal, that's universal. Socrates is a man, particular, therefore Socrates is mortal. Or to stick with my rabbit metaphor, where is it now? No dogs are rabbits. Alfalfa is a dog, therefore alfalfa is not a rabbit. Okay? So the deductive argument. Deductive arguments, if the premises are true, if no dogs are rabbits, and alfalfa really is a dog, then it has to follow, it has to be true, that alfalfa is not a rabbit. Okay? And so these are particularly strong arguments. Correct reasoning in this form, we say the argument is valid. I'll give you another valid argument. All rabbits are fluffy. Thumper is a rabbit, therefore Thumper is fluffy. Okay? So if it's true that all rabbits are fluffy, if it's true that Thumper is a rabbit, then it has to follow that Thumper is fluffy. Okay? Now we say this argument is valid if we're not sure that it's true that all rabbits are fluffy. I don't know, do you get rabbits that are like Siamese cats? That aren't fluffy. But maybe there are. And so if that premise is not true, my argument holds in the sense that it's valid, but it's not sound, because one of the premises can be questioned. Okay? Technical terms for those of you who are more interested. Now listen to this one. All rabbits are living things. My husband is a living thing. Therefore, my husband is a rabbit. Okay? Problem. This is where formal logic kicks in. That syllogism has to be written in a specific way. The terms have to be organized in a certain sequence. Okay? unfortunately, as fun as they are, especially thinking of Simon with big rabbit ears, then we can't go there today because we don't have enough of the formal background to it. But that's where these can go. We're going to look at some of the more sort of informal fallacies. Okay, so Peter Craig in his book on Socratic logic says this, and I think this is so valuable. There are three questions you should habitually ask yourself when writing or speaking, and of others when you read or listen, when you're reading or listening to them. Number one, are the terms all clear and unambiguous? Does this person do a bait and switch somewhere along the way, where in the beginning the term means this, but as they move through their argument, the actual meaning of the term starts to change? Okay. Number two, are the premises true? When the person says, this is that true? Can you find evidence that it is not? Does the person provide convincing evidence that this is in fact the case? And finally, is the reasoning logically valid? Can it be put in a syllogism that works? Premise, conclusion. Now, the skill is to be able to do this specifically with things that we read. So you take a newspaper article and somebody's trying to convince you of, let's say, an economic principle. What will he or she do? Well, somewhere in the point they will hopefully define their terms. Okay. Then they will set up some propositions, okay, some premises where they'll say, this is the case, here are my arguments why. This is the case, here are my arguments why. Therefore, this is my conclusion. Okay. Now the skill for us as laymen walking on the street is to take that article, to remove all the fancy adjectives and the emotive speech and whatever else is going on in there, and to say, aha, I've seen his first premise. These are his reasons. Okay, I'm convinced. No, I'm not. Here's his second premise. These are the reasons. Convinced. No, I'm not. Does his conclusion follow? Okay? Any book that you read, non-fiction, a book that's trying to convince you of something, for example, these hardcore new atheists, this is what we want to be able to do. Get through the fluff and get to that core argument. This is the skill that we need. This is very satisfying. In fact, it ruins you for any news channel ever again, because the thinking is sometimes just so bad, and you start picking up on fallacies and unclear terms and false propositions, premises in there, and conclusions that don't follow, and it just infuriates you. So it's quite satisfying. Get yourself one of those foam bricks to throw at them when they're thinking is so bad. Okay, so if the answer to all three of these questions is yes, then the conclusion of the argument must be true. Now, of course, we should apply this not only to opposing views, but to our own. When I say that I hold to, for example, this argument for the existence of God, are my terms clear? Are my premises true? And does my conclusion follow logically, in a logically valid manner from it? All our own reasoning should be subject to these three questions as well. Okay. Now, there are two main branches of logic. Material logic, this is concerned with the content of the arguments, the words that we use, determining whether or not the proposition is true or false. It's concerned with the content. And then, so this is what you can fix in the house if you want. Formal logic has more to do with the rules according to which the arguments are arranged. Okay? So that's more like sort of the architect's plan and how things are structured together, where you put the material. Okay. Why is this important? Well, because there are two types of fallacy. That's what we've been hearing in now. Fallacy is simply a mistake in your reasoning. Okay. Faulty argumentation. There are two types. There are material fallacies and there are formal fallacies. The formal fallacies, Simon ends up being a rabbit. Those are the ones that we're not going to be looking at today. Material fallacies have to do with the content. The way I define my terms, whether my propositions are true or false, what sort of evidence I get for that. Okay, so mistakes in the content of the argument is what we're going to be looking at, not so much mistakes in the structure of the argument. That's for your own further research. Right, so let's look at some of these. Most of the mistakes that hinder our conversation, argumentation, and understanding are material fallacies. We're going to spend the rest of our time looking at some of these. I'm going to use Peter Crave's book, Socratic Logic. He identifies 7 broad categories, and he lists a total of 49, and these are increasing all of the time as well as people come up with new ones. I'm just going to point out a few instances, and I'll try and give you some examples so that the fallacy can really get home and you can see it, and then hopefully you can remember some of them and go and apply it to whatever you read and start seeing them out there. Okay, so let's start with one. Material fallacies. First up, we have fallacies of language. So there's the fallacy of equivocation. A term is used in more than one sense in an argument. Okay, a quick example of equivocation. I say to you, I went to the bank this morning and I caught a big trout. Was that what you thought I was going to say? Where did you think I was going? I went to draw some cash, right? So there's equivocation of the term. Bank can have more than one meaning, okay? And so I need to be clear on what exactly I mean when I use the word bank, for example. Okay, now here's an argument. This is sometimes an argument that is used by Christians to argue for the existence of God. Look really carefully. All laws require lawgivers. Okay, premise one. Premise two, natural laws are laws. So the law of gravity or whatever other natural law you want to think about. Therefore, natural laws require a lawgiver. Okay? And then we think that is God. Okay. There's a subtle problem, though, with the way in which the term law is used. Anybody pick up on it? You think you can see? Okay. There's a difference between the type of law that requires a lawgiver and a natural law. The type of law that requires a lawgiver is something like a moral law. Okay? Natural laws are things that we recognize. They are not things that we impose. Natural laws are different. And so there's a subtle difference between the term law in the first premise and the term law in the second premise. And so I would argue that that argument suffers from equivocation. Something like this, I think, would work better. Do I have a better one on here? If you say, for example, all instances of order is the result of intelligence. Okay? The laws of nature are instances of order, therefore the laws of nature are the result of an intelligence. I think that's a better argument, better sort of design argument if you want. Because in there, the only type of laws I'm talking about are the laws of nature that we recognize. Okay? So, the question to be asked is, are the terms clear? Or is there a subtle shift in what this term means throughout the argument? That's the fallacy of equivocation. Okay, another one. Another fallacy of language, slanting. Use of language that assumes value or disvalue of a thing in its description. There's a lot of that goes around. We sort of add almost an emotional or descriptive aspect to our language. Look at these, for example. Pro-choice versus anti-choice. Okay. That's slanting. Why? Because those of us who are not pro-choice aren't anti-choice. We just hold that the choice needs to be made earlier in the process. Okay. And so when somebody refers to me as anti-choice, that's slanting. It's really sort of devaluing my position before even making an argument. Or when I refer to somebody who is not pro-life as anti-life, okay, they might say, well, that is slanting, because I'm not anti-life. I'm just sort of pro the life and the choices of the woman, for example. Okay, so you often get this in politics, where people impose sort of an emotional aspect to it. They already make you think badly of this person or this view, simply by the way they use the language. Okay, and so again, the terms, the way the language is being used should be made clear. Perhaps more important, I think perhaps more correct terms in that specific debate would be pro-abortion and anti-abortion. Those seem to me to be more neutral. It doesn't have that slant either way. Fallacies of language. The straw man Beating down a straw man, easily done. Have you ever gotten angry at your little, I don't know, do you do these cute scarecrows on harvest time? Okay. Easy to beat down a straw man. What does that mean? Well, it's when you refute an unfairly weak version of an opponent's argument. So you set up sort of a bad version of their argument. It's not really what they say, and then you proceed to hammer it down and you say, there, see, it doesn't hold. I'll give you one. This is what Richard Dawkins does in his book, The God Delusion, to the cosmological argument for God's existence. He says, Aquinas, for example, claims that everything that exists has a cause. The universe exists, therefore the universe has a cause, and then Aquinas wants to say that cause is God. Okay? What is Dawkins going to say? Well, what caused God? Okay? Because according to the first premise, everything that exists has a cause. Does God exist? Well, yeah, that's exactly what you want to argue for, and therefore, Aquinas, this is just a silly argument. Okay? But this is actually a straw man, because what does Aquinas' argument look like? I don't even have it up there. The actual argument that Aquinas proposes is everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. Okay? And so therefore if God is a being without beginning, okay, then he is naturally sort of excused, not part of that first premise. It doesn't fall prey to the question, well, who created God? Okay? So can you see how Dawkins in his book is really sort of beating down a straw man? That's not Aquinas' actual argument. Looks similar, a lot of people miss it and think, oh, Aquinas is in trouble. But really, it's a straw man. So in the same sense, we've perhaps got to be careful of beating down straw man arguments of the atheist view. This imposes on you the responsibility to really understand what it is that they're trying to say before you just have a go at it. Okay, fallacies of diversion. The argument is addressed to the person rather than the issue. Okay? Ad hominem. At the man, if you want. And so this would be something like poisoning the well. Since Christopher Hitchens had a rather sad and pathetic life, his arguments against Christianity cannot be taken seriously. Okay? Does it follow that just because he was an alcoholic with, I think, several divorces and no real happiness in life, therefore his arguments against Christianity are necessarily false? No. Okay. Since Christians have wonderful lives in which they find much happiness and health and prosperity, therefore their views are necessarily true. Does that follow? No. Okay. So poisoning the well, sort of attacking the person, using an attack on the person to discredit their views, says nothing about his actual arguments. They need to be examined independently of who he was. Even if he was a drunk on stage, that does not refute his argument. It needs to be looked at separately. Or something like the genetic fallacy. I cannot accept your arguments against abortion because you are a man. Okay? Yes, we had that at the abortion clinic where Simon was speaking to a lady. Why does that not hold? Because an argument against abortion holds irrespective of your gender. If the premises are true, if life begins at conception, and abortion takes a life after conception, therefore abortion is the taking of life, or abortion happens after conception, therefore abortion is the taking of life, that argument holds whether you are male or female. The argument is independent of your gender. Just because you have never been able to give birth, or you've never had to carry the baby for 9 months, doesn't make your argument against it invalid. Maybe you'll hear something like, oh, you're just a Christian because you grew up in a Christian family. Okay? Your arguments for Christianity are invalid because you grew up in a Christian family. Okay? Well, you might be an atheist. Your arguments against atheism are invalid because you grew up in a non-believing family. Okay? Does where I grew up say anything about the truth of the claims of Christianity, the arguments for or against the faith? It doesn't. No, nothing about my background, nothing about where I learned it from, nothing about whether or not I even use it as an emotional crutch, okay, whether that's my reasons for coming to faith, whatever my reasons were for coming to faith, doesn't influence the truth or the falsity of Christianity, okay? And so all of those are genetic fallacies. Genetic is sort of the idea that where the argument was formed is more sort of important than the actual content of the argument. Those are all over the place as well. They're a lot of fun to catch onto. Okay. You're a Christian, really, because you grew up in that kind of place. Right. Another fallacy of diversion, an appeal to illegitimate authority. Now, let me say this. Because we are limited in our knowledge and understanding, simply as human beings, we cannot know everything. And so, therefore, a lot of what we know based on an authority. Okay? This is a complete part of human life. You go to university, you are not going to stand out there and practice your structural engineering and come to all of these principles and conclusions by yourself with every beam that drops on your head, okay? You are going to trust in the authority of the professor who teaches you what has been found before. People who hold, for example, to evolution and the biological evidences for that, they are trusting the experiment of a small few people who have actually seen, for example, an evolutionary experiment. They read the journals and they trust the scientific authority. Very few people actually have the privilege or the opportunity to do those sorts of experiments. And so in all walks of life, we have to trust authorities. The question is whether those authorities are legitimate. Okay, so I have a problem with saying evolution is false because Kirk Cameron says so. Okay? Unless he's going to show me some serious scientific credentials and give me some good scientific evidence, okay, I walk perilously close to admitting this fallacy, okay, when I want to base my objection to evolution based on what a movie star says, okay. I have another one there. I can think of. Another one off the top, due to illegitimate authority. I'm sure you can think of some and come up with some. Christianity is true because my parents told me so. Fallacies of diversion and baculum, appeal to force. This is true because if you don't think so, I will hit you with my fist, type of thing. So you get. This, have you ever heard this little slogan? God is dead, Nietzsche said. Nietzsche's dead, God said. Okay? What sort of argument is that? Well, I'll just bully you into a corner. You better believe in God. Have you ever seen sort of the turn or burn banners? Okay? Those are sort of like baculum arguments. Arguments with an appeal to force. You don't want to believe in God? Well, tough times ahead for you, type of thing. Those aren't valid arguments. What we want to look at is, why did Nietzsche say God is dead? What were his arguments? What did he see in life that made him think that? And how do we respond to those? Okay. I think that would be a more sort of logically valid and ultimately satisfying way of doing it. Okay. Ad populum. Oh, my kids love this one. But everybody does it, mommy. The appeal to the masses. Okay. Believing something or doing something simply because it is popular. Or snob appeal, implying, I'm one of your kind, just trust me, okay? So, for example, look at this. The notion of a timeless truth is based on an outmoded Greek metaphysic that we moderns have rejected. The idea that there is absolute truth, that's really old-fashioned. We modern people, and I include you in that sort of thinking, now, we know that there is no such thing as an absolute truth, except, of course, that statement, okay? And so you see how people get drawn into the idea that this is the cool way of going as far as thinking is concerned. But, mommy, nobody else is going to be wearing shoes in the park, therefore, I don't want to wear shoes in the park. It's the same type of reason as the 4-year-old. A lot of that is sad. Well, you know, all the other kids at school are reading these books, and so they seem to turn out right, and therefore can't be that bad. Instead of looking into the real arguments for or against. Appeal to ignorance. We know of no natural cause that could have produced that effect, therefore it must have been a miracle. Okay? Can I base an argument on something that I don't know? Okay? No. You can't do that. And so this is very dangerous. This is a very dangerous form of reasoning. Oversimplification. Oh. Quoting out of context. I always shiver in my boots before I do this one, but I'm going to go there because I think it's important. Jeremiah 11:29. Have you ever received that on a get well card? Or when you're going through a tough time and somebody wants to cheer you up? I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not harm you, plans to give you hope in the future. Therefore, every Christian can expect to be prosperous in this life. What is the problem with that argument? That passage comes from Isaiah. Have you read some of the other things that God says about Israel in the book of Isaiah? And the things that will happen to them because they do not follow after him? In the process of coming to the place where he wants them to be. Okay. And what happens to the Christian friend who reads that, puts their hope in it, and then things just don't turn out that way? Why? Because the passage has been taken out of context. This applies first and foremost to the life of Israel. This applies first and foremost to the way that God dealt with the nation that over and over and over again chose others above him. Can we say certain things about God's nature and God's character, and that he is faithful and that he's true? Yes, for sure. Does this mean that I'm going to prosper? No. And so we, even as Christians, have to be particularly careful with this one. So, every quotation that you read in a newspaper article or in a book, true good thinking, logical thinking, is to say, let me go and get that article, let me go get that book, and just see whether the author uses this in a legitimate way. Is he quoting this person out of context? If this is his only evidence for his premise and has been taken out of context, then I can legitimately say this is a false premise. So you really should be doing that with every quotation that you have. What is the time? Okay. I'll do... Let's see if there's one more fun one. yes. We'll go to... Oversimplification, 9/11 bombers were Muslims, therefore Islam is not a peaceful religion. Well, can you base that on the works of those men? No, where do you have to go? You have to go to the actual text, the actual life of the Prophet. That's oversimplification. Begging the question, I'm not going to go that now, that's a tricky one. That's when you assume a conclusion in one of your premises, you're sort of arguing in a circle. And I want to get to, where's the last one? Hasty generalizations. Here we go. Post hoc ergo propter hoc. This, therefore, that. I must be called to this new pastor because after I accepted it, we sold our house. Okay? The two things might be completely unrelated. The sun rises because the rooster crows. The good argument for why the sun rises in the east. Okay? So this is a fallacy where you... Two things that happen necessarily in time, maybe over and over again, necessarily connect them, seeing the one as the cause of the other. After couples convert to Christianity, their marriages are restored, therefore conversion brings restoration in marriage. Okay, not necessarily such a good argument. And on they go, argument from silence. The Gospel of John must have been written before AD 70 since it does not mention the destruction of the temple. Okay. I'm arguing from something which is not there. Maybe John just decided to stop at a certain point, even though the temple had been destroyed and he was not writing his own gospel later. So, there are plenty of those out there. I want to talk to you about a very handy resource that Ray happens to have on his table. It's called Traditional Logic by a chap with the last name Sullivan. It's a great introduction to the ideas that I ran past you today. It's a little lighter than Peter Craig's, which I also mentioned, but if you're willing to dive in on the deep side and run with the man who can be scathing in his critique of those of us who don't think logically, then Peter Craig's Socratic Logic is a good one as well. Both of these men are Catholics, I think, and so this is one thing where the Catholics are ahead of us. A traditional Catholic education still includes logic, Aristotelian logic, and so they do a great job of setting out the basics and pointing you in a direction for where to go next. I hope that didn't bore you stiff, and I hope that you'll be able